How many of you might be familiar with John Herbert Dillinger? You know John Dillinger? John Dillinger was probably the most famous American gangster of the 1930s. During the Depression era, he and his gang robbed 24 banks, and they robbed 4 police stations. Talk about daring and, we might say, brave, or a lot of bravado to do that, no doubt. John Dillinger escaped from jail twice. He was charged with, but never convicted of, the murder of an East Chicago, Indiana police officer who shot Dillinger in his bulletproof vest during a shootout. Dillinger's bravado was legendary. In the heyday of the Depression outlaw era, John Dillinger was the most notorious of all, standing out even above more violent criminals such as Babyface Nelson, Pretty Boy Floyd, and Bonnie and Clyde, all people we've maybe heard about but don't know much about. Media reports in the time were spiced with exaggerated accounts of Dillinger's bravado and daring and his colorful personality. Of course, he stood out because robbing police stations was something nobody else did at the time. Now, you might think, okay, well, thanks for that information. Doesn't do much good. But what if you looked just like John Dillinger? You think, well, that's not going to happen. Well, there was a gentleman by the name of Ralph Alvman who was a spitting image of the outlaw John Dillinger. Interestingly enough, this man, Ralph Alvman, was a law-abiding citizen from Brookville, Indiana, and almost could pass for John Dillinger's identical twin. Now, many times to look like a celebrity is something of a novelty and something people enjoy. Ralph Alvman did not enjoy looking like John Dillinger or vice versa. As if physical resemblance wasn't enough, historical accounts say both Alvman and Dillinger had a mole next to one eye, and they both had a scar on the left wrist. So talk about a case of mistaken identity. Since Brookville was only 54 miles from Dillinger's whole hometown of Mooresville, they were both from Indiana, mistaken identity easily took place. Alvman was arrested 17 times under the suspicion of being John Dillinger. Even when Alvman left his home state, he was still arrested in such cities as Detroit and Minneapolis. Although he was always released, Alvman often had to undergo stressful interrogation sessions to convince authorities he wasn't John Dillinger. Now, if that isn't bad enough, Alvman was shot 11 times under the supposition that he was John Dillinger. He became justifiably paranoid that a law enforcement official would kill him before he had the chance to prove his real identity. Now, of course, Alvman's ordeal finally came to an end when Dillinger was gunned down by federal agents. You might remember the story outside a movie theater in Chicago in 1934. Nonetheless, Alvman was offered many movie contracts because he looked just like John Dillinger. But as you might expect, he turned them down, wanting no association with this man whatsoever. But what a case of mistaken identity. If I were to ask you, are there any cases of mistaken identity in the Bible, you might say, well, I don't know. Let's take a look at Manasseh. If I asked you to identify Manasseh, you'd probably say, okay, yeah, we know the story. He was Ephraim's older brother, and he had that deal going on where Joseph brought Ephraim and Manasseh, the brothers, to Jacob for that final blessing before Jacob was to die. And Manasseh, in one sense, at least according to Joseph, felt like he was getting the short end of the stick. One hand crossed over to Manasseh, from Manasseh to Ephraim. The right hand went on the younger brother. And Joseph said, no, Ephraim, this is the one that's older. And Jacob said, I know, but this is what. And you might think, okay, Manasseh got the short end of the stick. In one sense, he didn't get the firstborn blessing, but he did, prophetically speaking, become this great nation. You might associate Manasseh, of course, with the United States and the prophetic fulfillments there. And if you thought any of those things, I would say you're absolutely wrong. Because that's not the Manasseh I'm referring to. That's a case of mistaken identity. There's another Manasseh in the Bible that we're going to talk about today. With this as an introduction, let's take a look at the other Manasseh. The Manasseh, not the son of Joseph, the brother of Ephraim, but the Manasseh who was one of the kings of Judah. Let's see what we might learn from the life of the other Manasseh. Turn with me, if you would, to 2 Kings chapter 18. There are a number of lessons that we can learn from Manasseh. Manasseh, who was the son of a famous king, a much more famous king, we might say. Here's the first point. As we look at Hezekiah's life in 1 Kings 18, the first point is this. Righteous parents are not guaranteed righteous children. Righteous parents are not guaranteed righteous children. What we'll come to see is that God deals with individuals as individuals. Each stands before God on his or her own merits. And even though righteous parents strive to do all they can to produce righteous offspring, it is not guaranteed. Let's look at 2 Kings chapter 18 and verse 1. Because we'll start with this story of a very righteous man, a very righteous father. He wasn't a father yet at this point, but a very righteous man. Verse 1 of chapter 18 in 2 Kings says, "Now it came to pass in the third year of Hosea, the son of Elah, king of Israel, that Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign." So we begin with the story of the father, Hezekiah. He was 25 years old when he became king, and he reigned, we might say, a total of 29 years in Jerusalem. So he did not live to be an extremely old man. 25 and 29 is how much? 54 years old. But he reigned for almost 30 years. His mother's name was Abi, the daughter of Zechariah. And, verse 3, he did what was right in the sight of the Eternal, according to all that his father David had done. We might say Hezekiah was one of the most righteous kings that Judah ever had the honor or privilege of being under. He wasn't the only righteous king, but he certainly developed a sterling reputation for following God. It says he did all according to what his father David had done. Now, David wasn't his father. It was meaning the descendant of. He was his great-great-great-grandfather. But the point was, he was a descendant of David. And as he looked back, he did what David did. Now, Hezekiah is not called a man after God's own heart, the way David was, but he had a very similar heart and approach. Verse 4, how did that actively become carried out? He removed, verse 4, the high places and broke down the sacred pillars, cut down the wooden image, and broke in pieces the bronze serpent that Moses had made. For until those days, the children of Israel burned incense to it and called it Nehushtan. So here were the Israelites gone completely into idolatry, following false gods. They even made a god out of the serpent that Moses had made. Remember the story back there in Israel? Israel rebelled. God sent fiery serpents, in other words, poisonous serpents, to bite them. So you have this swarm of snakes. I can't think of a more terrifying punishment than swarms of snakes coming into your camp. So Moses had this bronze serpent made, put on a pole that now the medical community in America has taken over as its symbol of healing. And if they looked to this after being bitten by a serpent, they would be healed. Well, they made a god out of this. And so Hezekiah had it cut to pieces and burned up. Verse 5. He trusted in the eternal God of Israel, so that after him was none like him among all the kings of Judah, nor who were before him. So it's not unreasonable to say that after David, this was probably the most righteous king to ever have sat on the throne of Judah. Verse 6, for he held fast to the Eternal. He did not depart from following him, but kept his commandments, which the Eternal had commanded Moses. The Lord was with him. He prospered wherever he went, and he even rebelled against the king of Assyria and did not serve him. He was able to throw off the yoke of the Assyrians. God blessed him in that way. He subdued the Philistines as far as Gaza and its territory from watchtower to fortified city. It's not the same Gaza, by the way, that's in the news right now. This was a city on the Mediterranean coast. Point was, Hezekiah was a very righteous individual. Followed God to a T. Yet, being a righteous parent does not guarantee righteous children. Oh, how we wish it would. How we wish that if we are righteous and pray, then our children will automatically follow in those footsteps. Doesn't always happen that way. If we turn to 2 Kings chapter 19, page over, we'll begin reading in verse 14. Small example from Hezekiah's life about how to respond to the challenges that came upon him in a righteous way. As you may remember, we just read that Hezekiah was able to throw off the yoke of the Assyrian bondage. So he didn't pay taxes anymore or tribute to the Assyrians. Well, obviously they didn't take very kindly to that. So when another king in Assyria came to power, they were going to rectify that wrong, send the armies to Jerusalem, surround Jerusalem, and either get that tribute reestablished or destroy the Jews in the meantime. Well, a letter was sent to Hezekiah saying, "The Assyrians, we have destroyed every other nation. Who do you think you are to revolt against us? You better start paying or we're going to destroy you." In essence, is what the letter said. Verse 14, Hezekiah received the letter from the hand of the messengers and read it. And Hezekiah went up to the house of the Eternal and spread it before the Lord. Been some letters that I've read, maybe you have as well, on your knees before God to ask for God's guidance, to ask for God's intervention. Verse 15. Hezekiah prayed before the Eternal and said, "O Eternal God of Israel, the one who dwells between the cherubim, you are God. You alone, of all the kingdoms of the earth, you have made heaven and earth," way above any gods on this earth. Verse 16, "Incline your ear, O Eternal, hear. Open your eyes, O Eternal, and see. And hear the words of Sennacherib, which he has sent to reproach the living God." What was Sennacherib doing in the letter? He was saying, all these other nations turned to their gods. We've destroyed all of them. And we've destroyed their gods. Your God's in the same category. We're going to destroy him and destroy you. And Hezekiah is saying to God, "God, they're putting you in the same category as all these pagan idols. So they're insulting you." Verse 17, "Truly, Eternal, the king of Assyria have laid waste the nations and their lands and have cast their gods into the fire. For they were not gods, but the work of men's hands, wood and stone. Therefore, they destroyed them. Now, therefore, Eternal, our God, I pray, save us from his hand, on all, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you are the Eternal God, you alone." So what a great prayer that Hezekiah prayed before God, asking for intervention. And God did. God intervened, turned the Assyrians around, and sent them back home in a spectacular deliverance. Turn over a page again to chapter 20. 2 Kings 20 in verse 1. After all these things, God intervened. We might back up to the end of chapter 19 and verse 35. It came to pass on a certain night, the angel of the Eternal went out and killed in the camp of the Assyrians 185,000. God just stopped their hearts, apparently, and they were dead in their beds. God intervened. Hezekiah's righteousness, his dedication, turning to God, was what God apparently used to justify this intervention. Goes on to say, when the people arose early in the morning, they were all corpses, all dead. So Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and went away and returned home and remained at Nineveh. And again, it goes on to say that he was then murdered by some of his sons. Chapter 20. In those days, Hezekiah was sick and near death. Now, if we were talking about lessons from the life of Hezekiah, we would say something like, righteous people get sick too. And they might even die. That happens. It happens to all righteous people eventually. They die. Nonetheless, Hezekiah was sick and near death. Now we wonder, how old was Hezekiah at this time? He was not old, as we might think of elderly today. At 54, dying was not, he was not old. But at this point, Hezekiah was apparently 39 years old. We'll tell you how we figure that out in a moment. Isaiah the prophet, the son of Amos, went to him and said to him, thus says the Eternal, set your house in order, for you shall die and not live. You're going to die. He, Hezekiah, turned his face to the wall and prayed to the Eternal, saying, remember now, O Eternal, I pray, how I've walked before you in truth and with a loyal heart and have done that which was good in your sight. And Hezekiah wept bitterly. Now, was Hezekiah just so attached to physical life that he cried out to extend the physical life? I don't think that was all there was to it. It seems that Hezekiah did not have a son at this point to take over the kingdom after him. So one of the reasons he may have been weeping bitterly is because there was no one to carry on the throne, no son of his. And it happened before Isaiah had gone out into the middle court that the word of the Eternal came to him, saying, return and tell Hezekiah, the leader of my people, thus says the Eternal, the God of David, your father, I have heard your prayer. I have seen your tears. Surely I will heal you. God reversed his decision. On the third day you shall go up to the house of the Eternal. In other words, you'll be healthy again. Verse 6, and I will add to your days 15 years. If he was 25 when he began reigning, reigned for 29 years till the age of 54. We subtract 15 from 54, he was 39 years old. I will add to your days 15 years. I will deliver you and this city from the hand of the king of Assyria, and I will defend this city for my own sake and the sake of my servant David. Now, as an interesting sidelight, God, even in spite of Hezekiah's righteousness, may have allowed the city to fall because of the unrighteousness of everybody else. One man's righteousness will not spare everybody else all the time. Isaiah said, and now you talk about historical precedent. There was a time when Sodom and Gomorrah were spared because of one man's righteousness. And when the time came, God said, get the righteous guy out of there. I'm destroying them. And that's about what was to happen here. Get Hezekiah out, because I'm going to destroy it because of their unrighteousness. Now, he's taking Isaiah or Hezekiah out in this case by death. But now, because of Hezekiah's prayers, God added 15 years to his life. Isaiah said, take a lump of fig. So they took, laid it on the boil, and he recovered. So apparently you have a boil, stick some fig Newtons on it, and you'll be A-OK. Well, not necessarily. This was divine intervention. Hezekiah said to Isaiah, what is the sign that the Eternal will heal me, and that I shall go up to the house of the Lord on the third day? Isaiah said, this is a sign to you from the Eternal. The Lord will do the thing he's spoken. Shall the shadow go forward 10 degrees or backward 10 degrees? Hezekiah said, it's easy for the shadow to go down 10 degrees, but let the shadow go backward 10. So Isaiah the prophet cried out to the Eternal. He brought the shadow 10 degrees backward, by which it had gone down on the sundial of Ahaz. So God just simply created this miracle. He didn't pause time. He didn't stop the rotation of the earth. He didn't back things up. But he simply created this miracle to appear that the sun had gone back 10 degrees. So fascinating thing. An outstanding individual. A righteous man in every respect. Striving to lead his people in a righteous way. Now, we said one of the reasons Hezekiah may have been weeping bitterly was because he did not have a son to sit on the throne after him. Well, apparently when he was granted the 15-year extension, he got busy on that routine. Because he had a son. And that son was the young man Manasseh. Let's drop down to verse 20 here in chapter 20. The rest of the acts of Hezekiah and his might, and how he made a pool and a tunnel and brought water into the city, are they not written in the book of Chronicles of the kings of Judah? So Hezekiah rested with his fathers. Then Manasseh, his son, reigned in his place. Hezekiah's tunnel, famous to this day, to bring fresh water inside the walls of Jerusalem so they could withstand an attack. Chapter 21, in verse 1. Manasseh was 12 years old when he became king. So he was born 3 years after that life extension. He was 12 years old when he became king. And he reigned 55 years in Jerusalem. 55 years. That is the longest reign of any king of Judah. 55 years. And Manasseh was what we would call a rat fink. He's a bad man. We'll come to see that. But there were other kings. Azariah reigned for 52 years, Joash for 42, Asa for 41, Josiah for 31, Hezekiah and Amaziah both at 29, Jehoshaphat at 25. All those that I listed were righteous kings. And yet none of them reigned as long as unrighteous Manasseh. Now, logically, that doesn't make sense to us. Bad guys should finish last, not first in our mind. But God has a way of doing things a little bit differently than we might. His judgment is perfect. We ask, why was Manasseh the way he was? Notice verse 2. He, Manasseh, did evil in the sight of the Eternal, according to the abominations of the nations whom the Eternal had cast out before the children of Israel. Went right back to all the idolatry of the heathen peoples that Israel and Judah were supposed to throw out. Righteous parents are not guaranteed righteous children. We cannot make our children righteous as much as we would like to. Interesting that here, righteous Hezekiah is never accused of mismanaging fatherhood. We don't read here that Hezekiah did such a lousy job as a parent that his child turned out to be a demon. Doesn't say that. Righteous Hezekiah. Now, we ask, Why might have Manasseh turned away from his father's way of life? Why did he do that? And if you come up with an answer, let me know. Because the Bible does not identify it. Now, we might say, well, you know, Hezekiah had him in his old age. Well, wait a second. 42 is not old age. It's barely middle age these days, isn't it? Doesn't middle age start about 60? Middle age is always about 5 years older than I am. So I think it's about 60 that middle age begins now. 42 is not unusual at all to become a parent. So he wasn't an old man. You think sometimes of older parents coddling little ones and spoiling them? Not necessarily. May have had something to do with it. We don't know. Maybe he simply caved into his carnal desires. Maybe there were very evil individuals around that influenced him. Maybe he was just a snot, to put it bluntly. We don't know. Maybe he desired to set himself apart from his father's life. He didn't want to be Mr. Goody Two-Shoes. So he was going to do his own thing. We don't know. We simply have no indication as to why he turned out the way he did. But it often can be comforting to parents to know that even though we strove as much as we possibly could to give our children a chance to be righteous, it's up to them. God will deal with each of them as individuals, specifically, apart from us. Now, it is true that our children, those of righteous people, do receive a great blessing by being raised in a godly household. But it will not guarantee that they likewise will be righteous, at least at this time. Here in chapter 21, we see a second lesson we can learn from Manasseh. And that is, bad leadership can influence others to sin. Bad leadership can influence others to sin. Now, as we've said, every tub sits on its own bottom. Everyone's responsible for themselves. Yet, leadership does have a tremendous influence. 2 Kings chapter 21. Again in verse 2. Manasseh did evil in the sight of the Eternal according to all the abominations of the nations whom the Eternal had cast out before the children of Israel. Like what? Verse 3. For he rebuilt the high places which Hezekiah his father had destroyed. Doing exactly the opposite of what his father had done. Was he trying to spite his father? Was he simply establishing his own identity? We have no idea what was going on in Manasseh's mind. Were there others who inspired him, who convinced him that his father's way was foolish? He raised up altars for Baal. And, made a wooden image, it goes on to say, as Ahab, king of Israel, had done. And he worshipped all the host of heaven and served them. Verse 4, he also built altars in the house of the Eternal, of which the Eternal had said in Jerusalem, I will put my name. So now, instead of one altar of incense in the temple, there were many. To all these gods, he's equating the real God with all these pagan gods, all these idols. Verse 5, he built altars for all of the host of heaven in the two courts of the house of the Eternal. Just completely destroyed the holiness of the temple. Also, he made his son pass through the fire, practiced soothsaying, used witchcraft, consulted spiritists and mediums. He did much evil in the sight of the Eternal to provoke him to anger. So apparently he sacrificed his own son, burned him in the fire to the pagan gods. Absolutely ghastly behavior. And those who had known Hezekiah must have said, I cannot believe this child's behavior. Many would have said, Hezekiah must be rolling over in his grave, as the saying goes, to think that his son would be doing these things, consulting witches and mediums, spirit world. Ghastly behavior. Verse 7, he even set a carved image of Asherah that he had made in the house of the Eternal, which the Eternal had said to David and to Solomon his son, in this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen of all the tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever. So actually carved a statue, placed it in the temple. Unbelievable behavior. Now again, were there others influencing Manasseh? No doubt there would have been. But what a tragic situation. Verse 8. And I will not make the feet of Israel wander any more from the land which I gave their fathers, only if they're careful to do according to all I've commanded them, and according to all the law that my servant Moses commanded them. What is he setting up? He's setting up the fact that there's about to be destruction because they have wandered away from worshiping the true God. Verse 9. But they paid no attention to those commands, and Manasseh seduced them to do more evil than the nations whom the Eternal had destroyed before the children of Israel. Bad leadership can influence others to sin. Sometimes children come in contact with bad influence. Sometimes they make decisions on their own. So we see Manasseh's influence also pulled others into this sin. And there may have been some rather convincing fruits, we might say. He may have said, if this is wrong, how come the Assyrians haven't attacked us? How come the Assyrians haven't taken us over? If this is wrong, how come we're prospering? See, they could look at the statistics and say, you know, wheat production is pretty good. We better keep praying to these pagan gods because things are going pretty well. He began to entice, as it says here, others. He seduced them to do more evil. You ought to sacrifice your sons as well because it's obviously working. Bad leadership can influence others to sin. Righteous parents are not guaranteed righteous children as much as we desire that. There's a third thing we can learn from the sad story of Manasseh, and that is unrighteousness eventually brings judgment. God is not asleep. He is not unrighteous to forget works of righteousness, and likewise, He will not forget works of unrighteousness as well. Unrighteousness eventually brings judgment. It's interesting, the name Manasseh means forgetting. Forgetting. Now, when Joseph named his son Forgetting, it was for a very different apparent meaning than this. Joseph said, I want to forget all those years I spent in prison. Now I'm out. I have this beautiful firstborn son. He's washed away all that past. You hold that little baby, and life is new. So he named him Forgetting, or Making to Forget. In sadness, Manasseh, although his name here means making to forget or forgetting, it's clear that he forgot God. He forgot God's law. He forgot what right behavior was. So his name, Forgetting, took on a very different meaning than the original son of Joseph, Manasseh. When we forget God, sins committed in our youth can have a very deleterious effect on our adult lives. Some sins have very bad effects that carry on for a very long period of time. And Manasseh unfortunately made decisions in his youth that would carry out terrible consequences off into the future. 2 Kings chapter 21 will continue on in verse 10. The Lord spoke by his servants the prophets, saying, because Manasseh, king of Judah, has done these abominations, then in parentheses, he has acted more wickedly than all the Amorites who were before him, and has also made Judah sin with his idols. Not only did he take on the ways of the pagans, he did it worse, because he combined all of these evil practices into the land. Verse 12. Therefore, thus says the eternal God of Israel, behold, I am bringing such calamity upon Jerusalem and Judah that whoever hears of it, both his ears will tingle. And I will stretch over Jerusalem the measuring line of Samaria and the plummet of the house of Ahab. I will wipe Jerusalem as one wipes a dish, wiping it and turning it upside down. There'll be nothing left. Unrighteousness eventually brings judgment. 50 years of disobedience. But God doesn't count time the way we do. Judgment would come. Verse 14, so I will forsake the remnant of my inheritance and deliver them into the hand of their enemies, and they shall become victims of plunder to all their enemies because they have done evil in my sight and have provoked me to anger since the day their fathers came out of Egypt even to this day. This is kind of the culmination. God's finally saying, I've had it. We're done. Moreover, Manasseh, verse 16, shed very much innocent blood. He was a murderer on top of everything else. Here is righteous Hezekiah following God to a T, striving to lead the nation to righteousness, and his son turns the whole thing completely upside down. It says he shed very much innocent blood till he had filled Jerusalem from one end to another. Beside his sin by which he made Judah sin in doing evil in the sight of the Eternal. Did evil toward God and idolatry, did evil toward fellow man. Now who do you suppose the innocent blood was that Manasseh was murdering? Well, we don't know. Was it just other pagans for material gain? Or was it those who defied his behavior, standing for what was right? Were some of these the martyrs, the prophets? Possibly, we're not told. Sad to see this kind of behavior. Now in verse 17, it simply says, the rest of the acts of Manasseh, all that he did and the sin that he committed, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the king of Judah? So Manasseh rested with his fathers and was buried in the garden of his own house in the garden of Uzzah. Then his son Ammon reigned in his place. And it makes it look like, wow, he just died a happy death and that's all there was to it. Well, let's go to the book of Chronicles. 2 Chronicles chapter 33. Because it gives a bit more detail that is not given here in 2 Kings. Now, whether this is the book of Chronicles that the book of Kings refers to is sometimes hard to establish because the indication is there'd be much more detail in the chronicling of the kings than would be here in 2 Chronicles. But nonetheless, we'll look at this. 2 Chronicles chapter 33 tells the story of Manasseh again. Manasseh, verse 1 of chapter 33, was 12 years old when he became king. He reigned 55 years in Jerusalem. But did evil. He did evil in the sight of the Eternal according to the abominations of the nations whom the Lord had cast out before the children of Israel. As we read, he rebuilt the high places which Hezekiah his father had broken down. He raised up altars for the Baals, the Baals, and made wooden images. And he worshipped all the host of heaven and served them. He also built altars in the house of the Eternal, which the Lord had said, in Jerusalem shall my name be forever. And now all these other pagan gods are there as well. Verse 5. He built altars for all the host of heaven in the two courts of the house of the Eternal. He also caused his sons, plural, to pass through the fire in the valley of the sons of Hinnom. He practiced soothsaying, used witchcraft and sorcery, consulted mediums and spiritists. He did much evil in the sight of the Eternal to provoke him to anger. He even set a carved image, the idol which he had made in the house of God. Of which God had said to David and Solomon, his son, in this house and in Jerusalem, which I have chosen of all the tribes of Israel, I will put my name forever. And now another name is associated with that. Verse 8. And I will not again remove the foot of Israel from the land which I have appointed for your fathers, only if they're careful to do all that I've commanded them, according to the whole law and statutes and the ordinance by the hand of Moses. So Manasseh seduced Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem to do more evil than the nations whom the Eternal had destroyed before the children of Israel. So far, it's exactly the same account as we read in Kings. But there's more to it. Verse 10. The Eternal spoke to Manasseh and to his people, but they would not listen. If Hezekiah was there, would Hezekiah have spoken to this child? Manasseh, what are you doing? But apparently Manasseh was not of a heart to listen. Why that heart was there, we're not told. But that heart could change. Verse 11, punishment begins. Therefore, the Eternal brought upon them the captains of the army of the king of Assyria. What happened? Who took Manasseh with hooks. We'll pause there for a moment. The Assyrians were a particularly vicious people. When they conquered others, there was very little mercy ever extended. So when it says they took hooks, many historians believe that literally these were metal hooks put through the jaws of the captives to carry them in line to wherever they were being taken. Now, others say these were nooses tied around their necks, but others feel that they were literal hooks like fish hooks put through people. They bound him with bronze fetters and carried him off to Babylon. And you say, well, that's very cruel. And it certainly is. At the same time, he was the most evil king Judah had ever experienced. So he was getting what he deserved, maybe less than he deserved, for influencing hundreds or thousands of peoples to turn against God. So Chronicles does add a bit more detail that he was carried off in captivity with possibly even a hook through his jaw, chained and carried off to Babylon. Now we learn one final lesson from Manasseh, and that is God is very merciful. God is very merciful. Why do we say that? Well, verse 12 tells a story that the book of 2 Kings did not relate. All 2 Kings said was Manasseh died and was buried in the tomb of his fathers and his son took over. But fascinatingly enough, it was this punishment, being carried off to Assyria with a hook in the jaw or a noose around the neck, that helped Manasseh to repent. Verse 12, now when he was in affliction, he implored the Eternal his God. What his father had undoubtedly taught him as a young child was still in the brain. Still there. He didn't turn to Baal or the Asherah or any of the other pagans, Merodach or other gods that he must have been worshiping. His father would have taught him there is one God, the Eternal, Yahweh. He is the Creator God. He was taught. And that's where he returned in this time of worst trial. Now when he was in affliction, verse 12, he implored the Eternal his God and humbled himself greatly before the God of his fathers. All the bravado, all the I'm right, all the I can do whatever I want disappeared. And a deep humility replaced it all. He prayed to him, the God. And he, God, received his entreaty, his begging. God is very merciful. God had every right at this point to simply say, "You think I'm going to forgive you? You turn to me now? You've got to be kidding me. After all you've done, you get what you deserve, and that's all there is to it." But no, God's mercy, as David said, is high above the earth. As far as the east is from the west, is his mercy toward those who love him. I mean, Hezekiah, his teaching finally rang in the ears of Manasseh. Manasseh turned to God. God was merciful. Verse 13, he prayed to him. God received his entreaty, heard his supplication, and brought him back to Jerusalem into his kingdom as king once again. Fascinating how merciful God is. We're not told about Manasseh's repentance back in the book of Kings, only his evil. God is very merciful. And that's extremely encouraging to us to know that it's never too late for our Manasseh's children, grandchildren, etc. Brought him back to Jerusalem into his kingdom. Then Manasseh knew that the Eternal was God. Only God could do that. Verse 14, after this, he built a wall outside the city. We're not told in that 55-year reign, what year was it that Manasseh was hauled off to Assyria? How many years did he live as king after that? We're just not told. But it says, after this, he built a wall outside the city of David, on the west side of Gihon, in the valley as far as the entrance of the fish gate, and it was enclosed Ophel, and he raised it to a very great height. Then he put military captains in all the fortified cities of Judah. He took away the foreign gods and the idols from the house of the Eternal, and all the altars he had built in the mount of the house of the Eternal and in Jerusalem, he cast them out of the city. I'm talking about a total and complete turnaround. It's never too late. He also repaired the altar of the Eternal, sacrificed peace offerings and thank offerings on it, and commanded Judah to serve the Eternal God of Israel. He did his best to reverse the damage he had done. What an inspiring story. Nevertheless, the people still sacrificed on the high places, but only to the Eternal, their God. That would be the seed of future disaster, obviously, because they would turn these high places into places where they would sacrifice to the true God to sacrifice to the pagan gods that had been done before. God is tremendously merciful. Verse 18, now the rest of the acts of Manasseh and his prayer to his God, so literally the prayer was recorded somewhere, and the words of the seers, the prophets, who spoke to him in the name of the Eternal God of Israel. So not only would they have spoken to him during his bad years, they may have spoken to him in captivity. It's interesting that God's church, his representatives, are always there in the mix. Just part of things. The seers, he listened to the prophets. They would have said, your father told you. He taught you these things. The words of the seers who spoke to him in the name of the Eternal God of Israel, indeed they are written in the book of the kings of Israel. And again, the book of Kings that we have, the books of Chronicles we have, are not necessarily the same books being described, because we don't have in our book of 1st and 2nd Kings Manasseh's prayer written down. We don't have the words of the prophets, the seers, who spoke to him to encourage him to do what was right, to tell him what would happen if he did wrong. Those are other books, apparently, that God did not see fit to include in the inspired Bible. It'd be fun sometime to dig those up and read them. What exactly did they tell him? What was his prayer? Verse 19, also his prayer, and how God received his entreaty, and all his sin and trespass, and the sites where he built high places and set up wooden images and carved images before he was humbled. Indeed, they are written among the sayings of Hosea. So there's another book that we don't have. God didn't see fit to include that. We have enough to know. We don't need a list of all the sins, the individuals he may have been responsible to murder, the places, the locations where he set up all these evil things. We don't need those details. What we do need is that he was unrighteous. He repented. God was very merciful and he was restored. So, now we pick up in verse 20, the same thing we read as his conclusion to life in 2 Kings. So Manasseh then, after all this, rested with his fathers, and they buried him in his own house. Then his son Amon reigned in his place. What an interesting thing. So brethren, the story of Manasseh, sad one in many respects, but one of tremendous hope at the end. While righteous parents are not guaranteed righteous children, while bad leadership can influence many to sin, while we know unrighteousness eventually brings judgment, we also know God is very merciful, that it's never too late. And if the most evil king in the history of Judah can repent and turn to God and turn things around, there is tremendous hope for the future. So let us learn all that we can from this case, no, not of mistaken identity, but from the case of the king Manasseh.